Today, on Epiphany Sunday, which is this marks the end of Christmas time. So, if you're looking for an excuse to undecorate your house, today would be a good excuse. It's the end of Christmas on the church calendar. Today's Epiphany, and during Advent, we took a little break from our study of John's Gospel, and so today we turn back to it. We'll pick up where we left off in chapter 6. And in the first 15 verses of this chapter, we are reading about the event known as the feeding of the 5,000. And that's really not a good name for this event because Jesus did not feed 5,000. He fed 5,000 men. But Matthew's gospel says there are women and children there also. And so, really, we don't know how many people he fed, but we know there are 5,000 men. Conservative estimates are that this crowd could have been 20,000 people. So, I don't know, maybe my Bible says right above the chapter begins 5,000 fed. Maybe I'll scratch out the 5 and write in 20. 20,000, plus or minus, approximately fed. The significance of this miracle is understood by the fact that it is the only miracle that's recorded in all four of the Gospels. You know, each of the Gospels gives us certain unique perspectives on different events that take place in the life and ministry of Jesus. This is the only one recorded in all four. And John begins the chapter with these words. He says, "After these things." Now, on the surface, we would assume that these things would be the events recorded in the verses immediately before this. But when we look back on those verses, we notice that the last account took place in Jerusalem, and this one on the far side of the Sea of Galilee in that area that's today called the Golan Heights. So there's been a lot of ground covered between chapter 5 and chapter 6. Also, chapter 5 took place around some unnamed feast of the Jews, and chapter 6 verse 4 tells us that this is just prior to Passover. So, it's possible that if chapter 5 took place at the most recent series of feasts and festivals, it would have been about 6 months earlier. But it's possible also that that unnamed feast in John 5 was Passover. So that means we're a year beyond that. 6 months to a year have passed, we can say. So a lot of time and a lot of ground have been covered since chapter 5 ended and chapter 6 begins. Now, we know from the other Gospels that just before this time, Herod Antipas, the Roman puppet governor of the Galilean region, had ordered the beheading of John the Baptist. And we also know that Jesus had sent his disciples out on a mission trip, if you will, a ministry assignment around Galilee. And Herod had become so unsettled by the reports of what he was hearing that God was doing through Jesus and his followers that he began to wonder if John the Baptist had risen from the dead. And so with Jesus' popularity surging and crowds gathering wherever he went, Jesus decided to withdraw to the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, to the Golan Heights, and rest for a few days in fellowship with his disciples. He intended to use that time to debrief with them about the things they'd experienced in their ministry assignments. He desired to speak frankly with them about his future, including his death, and prepare them for what was to come. With hostility beginning to arise from the authorities, he certainly hoped that this time away would allow some of that excitement and scrutiny to die down a bit so that he could continue on until his mission was completed. And we also know that Jesus was seeking some private, quiet moments to grieve the death of John the Baptist, his kinsman, his forerunner, and his friend. But the crowd of people that was following Jesus would not relent. And so as Jesus and his disciples were crossing the Sea of Galilee by boat, the crowd traveled by foot around the northern end of the lake and met him on the other side. Now, why was this crowd following him so intently? John tells us in verse 2, they followed him because they saw the signs which he was performing on those who were sick. Now, the verbs in this verse are all imperfect, which indicates a continuing action. The large crowd was continuing to follow him because they continually saw the signs that he was continually performing on those who were sick. They were like so many others whom we've met in the Gospels that are interested in Jesus in much the same way that many today would be interested in a sideshow or a magician. There's some sort of curiosity about it, along with some selfish interest about how this power might be co-opted to work on our behalf. So they witnessed the miracles that were taking place, but they did not perceive the ultimate reality beneath the miracles. You see, the miracles of Jesus were signs, and signs are intended to point to something beyond themselves. And the miracles of Jesus were revelatory, in that God was using these events to reveal, to make known Jesus as God the Son, the Messiah who had come to redeem humanity from the curse of sin. Mark tells us in his account of this that when Jesus saw this crowd coming to him, he felt compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And so out of his compassion for these people coming to him, Jesus taught them many things. And this time of teaching went on. I am not the first long-winded preacher the world has ever known. Jesus taught them for a very long time. And the hour became late. And the disciples began to be concerned because they have this mob of people, maybe 20,000 people, and the hour's getting late and the people haven't eaten. And so one of the Gospels says that the disciples began to say to Jesus, you should really send these people away, you know, because it's getting late and they need to eat. I've been around church folks enough to know that probably it was the disciples who wanted to eat, and they were just pinning it on the other people. You know, oh boy, I'm getting hungry, but I don't want to tell Jesus, so we'll throw it off on them. I think these people are getting hungry. You should let them go. So Jesus takes action at this point. And he acts in a tremendously supernatural way in the performance of this miracle. And this miracle is no different than any of the rest of his miracles in that he is demonstrating something about himself. Now, the other Gospels draw attention to his compassion. And interestingly, it's not the feeding of the multitude that flows out of his compassion, but it's the teaching that flows out of his compassion. So what's being revealed in the feeding is something different than just his compassion for humanity. There's other attributes of Christ on full display here. And so as we see what he does, we come to understand more about who he is. And as we know more about who he is, that has the power to shape us as we seek to know him and follow him. And so the first thing I want to point our attention to here is in verses 5 through 10, we notice how Christ's infinite wisdom is revealed in his preparations. His infinite wisdom through his preparations. Now, I don't know about you, but when 2012 came to an end, I was pretty glad for it. It was a difficult year for me because over the last year, I've had several reminders in my life that I don't handle stress and anxiety very well in my own power. I don't know about you, but when things seem to get out of control, I tend to panic and scramble to try to wrestle those things back under rein. But what God has been teaching me through these things is that although things are often out of my control, they are never out of His control. And in His infinite wisdom, God is always at work in our circumstances in ways that we may not even perceive. And when He is at work, He is accomplishing something beneficial for us, even when we don't understand what that is. Now, I'm captivated by this phrase in verse 6 that says, He Himself knew what He was intending to do. You have to behold the chaos of this scene. I mean, the crowd is massive. The people are hungry. The hour is late. There is no food. There's no money to buy the food. And there's no place to buy the food if they had the money to buy it. If you ask the disciples, they would tell you things have gotten out of hand. In fact, Jesus did ask one of the disciples, Philip. Philip was a native nearby town of Bethsaida, so he was a natural choice to ask this question to. Jesus said, Philip, using your local knowledge of the place, where's the best place for us to go buy some bread for all these people? But John tells us that this question was only a test. It was a test to see how Philip would view the situation. Had Philip matured in his walk with Jesus to the point of trusting that Jesus knew what he was doing, or would he view it only through his human eyes and see things only from a natural perspective? Well, he shows us with his answer. He says, buy bread. Look, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for everyone here to receive just a little. 200 denarii was about 8 months' wages. I think the NIV renders it that way. And so, according to Philip, even if we could collect 8 months' wages for the ordinary worker, it wouldn't be enough to feed this crowd, even just more than a little bite. Philip failed the test. He was still looking at things through human eyes. He was still thinking with a natural perspective. He wasn't thinking supernaturally about what Jesus had the power to do. He wasn't real sure that Jesus knew what he was doing. So he responded to the situation by throwing up his hands and giving up hope. Buy bread? We don't even have enough money to buy that kind of bread. And even if we did, nowhere to get it. And so in his infinite wisdom, Jesus proved the spiritual mettle of one of his followers by a single simple question. But another disciple had a somewhat different perspective. And in his wisdom, Jesus had arranged circumstances in such a way that even a small glimmer of faith could shine through. And while Philip was crunching numbers in his head and seeing, as we had 20,000 people here and he wants to buy bread and we don't even have 800 denarii if we did, Philip's over there doing the math. He's thinking about what cannot be done. Andrew is looking for possibilities and opportunities. And so Andrew comes with a more positive report, albeit only a slightly more positive one. Andrew has gone around this massive crowd to see what he can muster up for feeding the people. He's trying his hardest to find a solution to the problem. And so he finds a boy, a lad. The Greek word is a person who would be from a small child up to possibly a man in his 20s. We don't know how old this person was, but he has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. Not much food. The loaves have been very small. That they were made from barley tells us that this was a poor person. Barley was the common staple for the poor. Jewish philosopher Philo said that barley was suitable for irrational animals and people in unhappy circumstances. So that's the kind of bread this boy was carrying around. And then the fish would have been just small little pickled fish that would probably just be used as a relish sort of to give those bland barley cakes some flavor. And Andrew says, well, look, I've looked around. I'm trying to find a solution to the problem here. And I found 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but it's not enough. In fact, one of the commentators refers to this amount of food as ludicrously inadequate to feed such a crowd. What are these for so many people, Andrew says. Philip's response to the situation was one of giving up hope. Andrew's response is one of trying harder. And what we will find as we go through difficulties in life is that neither of these approaches are sufficient. Giving up hope is not sufficient. Trying harder is not sufficient. So what are we to do? Well, Andrew's attempts to try harder don't solve the problem, but with faith, just as tiny as a mustard seed, he does the one thing that we all have to learn to do. He brought the boy with the food to Jesus, and the boy gave what he had to Jesus. I tell you, if nothing more had been done on that day, if the story were to end here, this would be a success story. Because you've never failed if you've brought someone to Jesus. And you've never failed if you've given what you have to Him. And so in His infinite wisdom, Jesus has arranged these circumstances so that Andrew would see the futility of his own self-effort. I've tried as hard as I can try to solve the problem, and it's not enough. I think the Lord wants you to see that. You can try as hard as you can to solve the problems you're in, most especially the problem of your alienation from God. Try harder, try harder, try harder, and you will see that it is not enough. What do? You come to Jesus and give Him what you have. You've never failed if you've done that. In utter desperation, Andrew does the only thing he knew left to do. Give it to Jesus. And that's what Jesus had been waiting for. He'd been waiting for someone to finally recognize that if the situation was going to improve, it was not going to be by giving up hope or trying harder, but by turning it all over to Him. But we'd also notice His infinite wisdom on display in verse 10, where we read that Jesus ordered the disciples to have the people sit down in the grass, and they did that. The other Gospels tell us that Jesus had the disciples to arrange them in groups of hundreds and fifties. You see, Jesus knew what He was intending to do. In order to do what He was intending to do, He took measures to do it well. He had the people to sit so that the crowd was stabilized and there was no rush on the food, and the serving of the food would be expedited, and perhaps so that everyone would have a better view of what was about to happen. They would be able to see the miracle that was about to take place with their own eyes. But don't miss this point, that Jesus desired to put His disciples to work in the mission. He gave them an assignment. Have the people sit down. Arrange the people into groups. Get ready. You're going to help me distribute this food. He gives them an assignment to carry out. So it wasn't necessary to do it that way. I mean, I suppose Jesus could have probably said, okay, everybody take a look at your hands. What's in them? Nothing. Okay, close your eyes. Now open them. Now what's in your hands? Wow, bread and fish. He could have done it that way. I don't think that would have been too hard for Him. But He uses people to accomplish His work. Just ordinary people. People like you and me. People with imperfect faith and people who are quick to give up hope. He puts these people to work. He creates opportunities for those who follow Him to serve Him. And He invites us to join Him in His work. It's a very wise thing for Jesus to set this all up in that way. I want to draw out some practical points for this. First of all, when a situation seems out of hand to you, are you confident that they're not out of His hands? Do you trust that He knows what He intends to do? That He knows what He's doing? How do you respond to stressful situations? Do you try to sort out the logistics of it all in your head and ultimately conclude that it's hopeless and give up? Or do you try harder to fix the problem in your own self-effort? Or do you take the situation to Jesus and hand it all over to Him? And through it, you know, are you looking for others that you can bring to Jesus in the midst of your circumstances and for ways that He might be inviting you to participate in His work through all of this? And when we behold His infinite wisdom, we come to understand He's always in control, even and especially when things are beyond our control. We're confident that as long as He is with us, we cannot give up hope because He knows what He is doing. He knows what He intends to do. He may be testing our ability to view things through the eyes of faith. And our response indicates whether we pass or fail the test. We understand that trying harder is not the solution, but entrusting matters to Him is. And so we see a place carved out for us by the very circumstances that we're in, a place for us to serve Him and serve others, and a place for us to bring others to Him, and a place for us to offer Him what we have. You see, only Jesus in His infinite wisdom can accomplish these things in the midst of a very chaotic scenario. Secondly, we see not only His infinite wisdom in the preparations, but we see His unlimited power revealed in the provision. Notice again Andrew's question in verse 9. Here's a boy with 5 loaves and 2 fish, and Andrew says, "What are these for so many people? 5,000 men, plus women, plus children, maybe 20,000 people are there. We've got one boy's snack to feed them all with. Not enough." But what everyone on that hillside is about to be faced with is the truth that though these are not enough, Christ Himself is enough. This small amount of food cannot meet their need. But this wonderful Savior can. And He provides for all of them with His unlimited power on display. Yeah, it's really interesting the lengths to which some people will go to undermine the authority of God's Word. This passage has been tinkered with by a lot of people over the centuries who simply refuse to believe that Christ has the power to do what He did here. There's a group of so-called scholars who say that if there was a miracle at all that took place here, it was really a miracle of the human spirit. You see, what happened on that hillside that day, they say, was that you had all these people who had food tucked away in their pockets and in their garments, and they were being selfish, and they didn't want to get their food out and have to risk sharing their food with somebody nearby. But then they saw the heroic example of this young boy giving his food to Jesus, and then that caused a melting of their hardened hearts, and they all said, well, if that boy could give his food to Jesus, then I suppose I could give my food to the person sitting beside of me. And so everybody began to share the food that they had in their pockets. Isn't that a creative way to understand this text? I can't fathom why, in the wake of an event such as this, that all these people would conclude that Jesus was the promised Messiah. I can't fathom why all these people would desire to make Him their king. I mean, you know, as soon as this is all done, as soon as the food is distributed, notice that it says, the people said, this is the prophet who's to come into the world. And so they began to make plans to make Him their king. I don't know why they would be celebrating Jesus if in fact the hero of the story was the boy with the food. Seems like they would be saying, let's make the boy the king, and let's follow him. No, that's not the explanation we're looking for. Then there have been others who've suggested that enough food was mustered up to give everybody present just a little bite. You know, like when we receive the Lord's Supper. If you've ever come to the Lord's Supper thinking you were going to get full, you know, everybody just got a little nibble. Well, if that seems very odd. I mean, certainly 5 loaves and 2 fishes wouldn't be enough to give everybody, 20,000 people, a little nibble. And if they had more food than that to begin with, then why the story of the little boy and his loaves and fish in the first place? But more importantly, notice how unlimited the power of Jesus is as he does what He does here. I mean, look in verse 11. Jesus then took the loaves, and having given thanks, He distributed to those who were seated, and likewise also of the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they were filled, He said to the disciples, gather up the leftover fragments. There's some important words there. What's the first thing He did? He gets the loaves and the fish. And the first thing He does is he gives thanks. Now, who did He thank? Well, maybe He thanked the boy. Well, thank you, little boy, for your bread and your fish. Now, the other Gospels indicate that what Jesus did was that he looked up into heaven. He looked up into heaven, and just as the boy had offered what he had to Jesus, so Jesus now offers up what He has to the Father. In the New American Standard and some other English versions, Matthew and Mark says that Jesus blessed the food. If you look at that text in Matthew 16 or Mark 6 in some English translations, you see He blessed the food, and the words "the food" are in italics, meaning they're not found in the original Greek text. They've been added by the translators, and I think in this case the translators got it wrong. I don't believe that Jesus blessed the food. I believe He blessed God by giving Him thanks for the provision of food. You know, I mean, sometimes you've got a need in front of you and you get a little bit of a provision and you say, is that all? I mean, that's I need more than this. I can't make do with just this. Notice what Jesus does. He's got 20,000 people to feed. 20,000 and 12. And He's got 5 loaves and 2 fish. Thank you, Father, for 5 loaves and 2 fish that You have provided for me to do this with. Have you given God thanks for what you have? You say, I don't have enough. Have you given God thanks for what you have? Jesus blessed God and gave Him thanks. The traditional Jewish prayer that would have been offered up before a meal might have been prayed by Jesus. It says, Blessed art Thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who bringest forth bread from the earth. Jesus is, by His actions and His words here, indicating that whatever we have from God's gracious hands. And whatever we have from God's gracious hands is enough to supply our needs. Now the text says that He distributed the food to the people. The other Gospels explain that He began breaking the bread and dividing the fish and giving it to the disciples, and they began distributing it. It's interesting that is what seems to be happening here is that as He broke the bread, He kept on breaking the bread. Now, how many times do you think you could break five pieces of bread? There was this little thing that we used to do in school to see if you could fold a piece of paper more than seven times in half. Have you ever tried that? If you fold it in half, you say, well, that was easy. You fold it in half, that was easy. You do it again, that was easy. And if you get down to seventh fold, it's really hard. In fact, I don't think you ever could fold it more than that, no matter how big the paper was. How many, you got a piece of bread, a little cake of barley bread here. How many times can you break it in half? Well, you break it in half this way and that way and this way and that way. And then you get down to where you're just crushing crumbs at that point. Right? He's got 20,000 people to feed. You do that five times, you got like maybe 30 pieces of bread. But what seems to be happening here is that the more He breaks it, the more there is to break. He just keeps on breaking it. And He's doing the same with the fish. He's dividing the fish and dividing the fish and dividing the fish. And the more He divides, the more there is. And the food's all being distributed. And notice that the people didn't just get a little morsel. It wasn't like the Lord's Supper where they just get a little tiny little square. No, it says the people had as much as they wanted, and they were filled. He didn't just have the power to create a little morsel for everybody. I mean, you know, even that would be a miracle, right? You have five loaves, two fish, 20,000 people, everybody gets one bite. That's a miracle. But everybody didn't get just one bite. Everybody got all they wanted. Maybe they only wanted one bite. I don't know. But they got all they wanted, and they were full. When they ate it, it was more than just a morsel. It was a satisfying meal. Philip was concerned. 8 months' salary won't buy enough, even for everybody to have just a little. But Jesus provides more than that with less than that. So abundant was His provision that there were leftovers. I love leftovers. Do you love leftovers? To me, the greatest thing about Thanksgiving is leftovers. I mean, you know, yeah, it's good to be together with family and all that, see everybody. And it's good to see everybody leave, and then you dive into those leftovers. Yeah. Well, so, you know, in keeping with custom, Jesus orders gather up all the leftovers. Jewish custom said anything bigger than an olive was not to go to waste. John only mentions the bread. Mark tells us there was fish left over too. And the leftovers, when they're all collected, amount to 12 baskets full. Verse 13, they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments. Now, I imagine as the disciples are out there, they say, where's all this bread and fish coming from? We're just giving it out, and there's just more to give out. And well, boy, I hope we don't run out. We're out here serving all these thousands of people, and He's not giving us any food. And then, lo and behold, the end of the meal comes. There's 12 disciples. There's 12 baskets. Each one of them gets enough food to last them several days. Well, sometimes we might think that we're being overlooked in the Lord's blessings. But even when we get the leftovers, we get enough to supply our needs. It's interesting to me that what they were left with, 12 baskets full, is actually more than what they started with, 5 loaves and 2 fish. That's interesting, isn't it? That when you just trust the Lord to take care of you, what you're left with is more than what you started with. His power is unlimited. A couple of practical points. Never underestimate the power of Jesus to meet your needs. That just because He can doesn't mean He always will in the way that you think is best. How He chooses to meet our needs is up to Him. Our part is to trust Him to meet our needs in the way that He knows is best. Secondly, we have to come to see that all that we have comes from His hands. I mean, just as Jesus received the bread and the fish from the boy and then thanked God for it, so we have to understand, no matter whose hands deliver the blessing, ultimately, those blessings come into our lives from the nail-scarred hands of Jesus. And whatever good things come our way are blood-bought blessings from Him. And all we deserve from Him is wrath. And so anything that's not wrath is a blood-bought blessing that's coming into our life, no matter whose hands deliver it to us. When we see the Lord providing for others in abundance, don't become bitter or envious about that. Rejoice that they are receiving such a blessing. Can you rejoice when other people are being blessed and you're not? That's a sign of spiritual maturity. When you, in your need, can rejoice over the provision that someone else is experiencing. Rejoice over that. And know that you will not be overlooked by the grace of God. Even if what you receive are the leftovers. You know, leftovers can be pretty good sometimes. And the leftovers of the Lord are far better than the main course of anybody else. And then when we observe His meticulous care, how He preserves even tiny morsels of food that have fallen to the ground. And shouldn't we delight in knowing that we are so much more valuable to Him than a little piece of food? And if He preserves even a little piece of food that falls to the ground, do you think He will not preserve you as well? I mean, you know, He will not suffer those who are His own to be trampled underfoot or to waste away and perish if He's going around having them collect little pieces of fish and bread. These things are being gathered into baskets. You're not being carried along in a basket. No, you're being held securely in that nail-scarred hand that provides for you. The meticulous care of His love. Unlimited power He has to provide. Infinite wisdom that He has is on display. But more than this, Jesus knew what He was intending to do. And ultimately what He intended to do was to reveal something even more important than His wisdom and His power. He reveals His saving purpose here in His person. I knew a pastor once who carried around a little card that he would leave in the door crack of someone he went to visit when they were not at home. And the card said, I came to tell you about Jesus. Missing me is no big deal, but missing Him is. And I think of that when I read miracle stories in the gospel. You see, the point of it is not that the people here get their bellies filled. Not a big deal that they got fed. But if they miss Jesus here, if they miss the significance of who Jesus is and why He did what He did, then that's a very big deal. It would be a tragedy to leave that hillside and rejoice over how delicious that bread. Have you ever had fish like that? Well, that's the best fish I've ever had. That would be a tragedy to walk away praising the fish and praising the bread. The one who provided it is what we're supposed to look at here. Jesus' intention was not just to put food in their mouths. This is the same Jesus who told the woman at the well back in chapter 4, you know, everyone who drinks of this water will thirst again. Yeah, everyone who eats this fish will hunger again. Everyone who eats this bread will hunger again. But Jesus can meet a deeper need and satisfy in an everlasting way. Just as He is able to satisfy their hunger with food, He can satisfy their greater spiritual need for all eternity. Once He meets the need of spiritual hunger in their lives, they will never hunger in that way again. Now when the people had eaten their fill, verse 14 says, they proclaimed, truly, He's the prophet who's come into the world. That's interesting. Of all the Old Testament references to the Messiah, they chose this one, Deuteronomy 18. Where Moses tells the people that in the future the Lord will raise up a prophet like Himself from among them. And certainly every genuine prophet of Israel was a partial fulfillment of that promise, but the right understanding of it is that the Messiah would come as the ultimate fulfillment and be that final prophet sent from God. And what's interesting about this is the people seem to be focused not on the prophet aspect of the statement in Deuteronomy 18, but the like Moses aspect. Is this the prophet? Well, he's like Moses. In what way is he like Moses? Well, you remember how Moses had the people out in the wilderness? And somehow Moses was able to feed them every day, and bread just showed up on the ground every day when they went out and they gathered up that manna. You know the Hebrew word for manna, you know what it means? The Hebrew word is manna, and translated it means, what is it? I think about that. You know, there used to be this candy bar called Whatchamacallit. Right? That's manna. You know, people would go out and say, hey, look, Whatchamacallit, it's on the ground again. They say, you know how Moses gave them the Whatchamacallits every morning? He's here giving bread and fish, and so he's like Moses. Well, Moses, manna, wilderness, Jesus, bread and fish, wilderness. This is all making sense to them, and so they say, we should make him our king. What if he doesn't want to be our king? It's okay, we'll take him by force and make him our king. Now, they didn't say that out loud. That's the problem with Jesus. You don't have to say things out loud for him to hear them. Sometimes I say things and I say, did I say that out loud? Well, you didn't have to say it out loud around Jesus. He perceived, it says, that they wanted to take him by force and make him king. Surely a mob of 20,000 people could do a lot of damage under a newly crowned king. But notice that nowhere here do we read that they were wrong in their conclusions. He's the prophet. In fact, he is. He is that prophet that Moses said was going to come into the world. Yes, he is. He's a king. Yes, he is. Yes, he is. The irony of their plan to take him by force and make him king is that he is already a king. They couldn't make him a king any more than he already was. But the problem was that he had not come to be the kind of king they wanted. In their minds, here's a king who can fill our bellies with magic food and rescue us from all the people that don't like us in the world. But in reality, if that's all that Jesus came to do for them, they wouldn't be any better off than they already were. Because the fact of the matter is, he came to satisfy a deeper need than physical hunger and to deliver them from a greater bondage than that they were under with Rome. He came to redeem them from sin and to reconcile them to God. And that victory would not be accomplished by defeating an army on a battlefield, but by defeating sin and death and Satan on the cross. Now, they wanted a king that would come and wield the spear and bring the judgment. But Jesus had come to be the kind of king that would receive the spear and bear the judgment on their behalf as he died for their sins. He was unwilling to become what they wanted. Why? Because he was steadfastly committed to being what they needed. Not a commanding general, but a suffering savior. So, rather than giving in to their corrupted desires, what does he do? He wanders off. He withdraws again, alone, this time not even taking the disciples. He goes further up into the Golan Heights. John MacArthur applies this important truth to us in this way. He says, Jesus comes to no man on that man's terms. People cannot manipulate him for their own selfish ends. People don't come to Christ on their terms so that he can heal their ailments and make them successful and help them feel good about themselves. No, instead, they must come to him on his terms. Even today, MacArthur says, he continues to withdraw from those who seek him for their own self-serving ends, just as he did from the crowd that sought to make him king on their own terms. What are you seeking in Jesus? You might just find that rather than coming to meet you and provide for that need, that desire, that he walks away in the other direction. Because he hasn't come to be for you what you want, but to gloriously be for you what you need. A few verses beyond our text here, Jesus will say, you seek me not because you saw signs, but because you ate the loaves and were filled. But then he says, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will not hunger, and he who believes in me will never thirst. Everyone, he says, who beholds the Son and believes in him will have eternal life, and I myself will raise him up on the last day. That is what we need. So what do you seek from Jesus? You seek in Him one who will always grant you what you desire? One who will be for you what you want Him to be? Or do you come to Him in humble recognition of your true spiritual need? That you're a helpless sinner, without hope before God, unless Christ in His mercy rescues you through His cross. Are you seeking a king just to sort of be your surrogate to reign over your little empire and follow your agenda for you? Or are you prepared to surrender to Him as king over His own kingdom and yield to His agenda as His servant? If you enter into His kingdom, then you're committing yourself to one who is infinitely wise, who knows your needs before you ask them, who meets those needs in the way that He deems best for you, and He welcomes you, and He bids you to become part of His kingdom and part of His work by His grace. In His unlimited power, He provides for you so that all that you have comes from His hand as a blood-bought blessing. He may be all that you have. And if He is, then gloriously and graciously you find Him to be all that you need. And as your king, He carries you through the battles, holding you in His hands. And when this life and this world has done its very worst to you, bringing you at last to the throes of death, He says, "Oh, you have eternal life, and I will raise you up on the last day." Oh, I pray that we would find all of our longings and all of our desires and all of our hunger satisfied in Him and in Him alone as we turn to Him and walk with Him by faith and trust that He knows what He's doing. And He is the bread of life. Let's pray.